Well, I hope you had a very good week this past week since last Sabbath. It's amazing how quickly time goes by. It seems difficult to keep up with everything, and it seems difficult, really, as we even look back sometimes, at least in my case, I look back and I wonder, well, all right, another week has gone by, so what has been accomplished? What have I done? And I know I was very busy all week, but sometimes, we can find ourselves thinking that, yeah, I'm spending a lot of energy, but am I really making much progress? Am I getting anything done? Well, it's a very simple principle that we can keep in mind that I want to focus on this morning that can help us to have that assurance that as time passes, we are making good use of it, and that the effort and that we put into our lives is something that is of value. Turn with me to Psalm 127, and we'll see right off what this principle is. Psalm 127. It's a familiar one, but I think it's worth considering from time to time to recognize its importance in our lives. Psalm 127. It's titled A Song of Solomon. The Jewish scholars believe that it really probably was not written by Solomon, but it is about Solomon rather than by him, especially in its reference to the house that's made here in verse 1, probably referring to the temple which Solomon had built. And by the time this psalm was written, it was probably during the time of Nehemiah when they were rebuilding that temple. But anyway, the principle is clear here in the first sentence of this verse. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. This first sentence makes an overall point that we're going to focus on this afternoon. We all work hard. We all work ourselves maybe sometimes beyond what is truly reasonable. And we can sometimes weary ourselves with effort. This can apply to just our daily life and the responsibilities we have, and it can apply as well to our larger effort, our larger work of practicing Christianity and living God's way and working toward the kingdom. But obviously, unless God blesses our efforts, then we really are not going to be accomplishing much. What we can do in and of ourselves is really so very limited. The title of the sermon this morning is Unless the Lord Builds the House. The second phrase in this verse goes on to make a similar point with a little different perspective. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It's really of no value that we labor as hard as we do, except for what the blessing that God puts upon our efforts. The second verse continues, it is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Working day and night, burning that candle at both ends, providing for the needs of our families, providing for ourselves, doing the things that we do that are so necessary, sometimes can be just a thankless and seemingly endless task. However, if we have God's blessing, then that effort certainly is of great value. We certainly must be diligent. There's nothing wrong with hard work, but in order for that work to be meaningful, requires the blessing that God can give to us. The point, again, was made in the first verse about God guarding the city. We certainly must take every precaution in our lives to be safe, to be careful about the way that we live. But what really matters is that God is watching over us. So with these points in mind that we see in the first two verses of this psalm, a couple of questions come to mind. How can we be sure that God does bless our efforts? How can we be sure that God is watching over our lives? The answer to that question is in part given in Psalm 128, the first verse in Psalm 128. Says, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. One of the most fundamental mistakes that people can make is to try to get by on their own efforts, failing to seek God's blessing, or perhaps being involved in the wrong kinds of activities, those that God simply will not bless. The answer that's given here is that God provides for our needs. He watches over, he loves and cares and protects those who fear him and who walk in his ways. Those who honor him, those who respect and yield themselves to him, and those who put their effort into living in a way that is according to what he teaches. Oftentimes, what people do is not necessarily wrong. It isn't that every activity that anyone, even outside of the church, is evil and wrong, but they may not be doing it in the context of God's ways and in the context of honoring and fearing him. We all are involved constantly in just ordinary things, ordinary tasks. We earn our living the same way that others earn their living. It's a matter of perspective. It's a matter of how we go about those activities, that we do so within God's law and with a frame of mind of loving and honoring and respecting him in everything that we do. It's part of that meditation and the thoughtfulness that we heard of in the sermonette, that when we frame our lives on what we understand of God through his holy days and through his law, then our perspective is entirely different. Turn back just a page or so to Psalm 121. Psalm 121. As we look here, we'll first of all note something about this psalm and those that follow. You'll notice in your Bibles that for Psalms 120 through 134, under the chapter number, most Bibles include a title such as a song of ascents. Ascent as in ascending or going up. Some translations label them as songs of degrees or pilgrim songs. This collection of 15 psalms has a particular nature to them and a particular place in the lives of those who worshipped God back in the times of the Old Testament. Here's a footnote from the Scofield Study Bible. It says that these 15 psalms, 120 through 134, are called songs of ascents, meaning the view generally accepted is that these psalms were either sung by pilgrims on their ascending march from Babylon, the captivity in Babylon, to Jerusalem, or that they were sung by worshipers from Palestine as they went up to Jerusalem for the great festivals, in other words, the annual holy days. So these songs were probably on the minds of those who were traveling, whether from Babylon captivity back to Jerusalem after they were released, or just simply along the route as they traveled from their homes to Jerusalem to observe the holy days. As the Jews return, that's the end of the quote from the Scofield Study Bible. So as the Jews returned from captivity, or as they approached Jerusalem to observe the festivals, they were literally looking up to the city of Jerusalem, which is situated in hills or mountains. Notice Psalm 121, verse 1 says, I will lift up my eyes to the hills, from whence comes my help. As they were returning or traveling to Jerusalem, they looked toward, or they looked up to the city of Jerusalem because it was in mountains or hills as far as its location. In fact, the elevation of Jerusalem is about 2,500 feet, which stands above most of the land of Israel. Just In the southern part of the area of Jerusalem is the Temple Mount, which stands about 2,500 feet as well in elevation. And just to the east of that is, across the Kidron Valley, is the Mount of Olives, which stands at about 2,700 feet. And Mount of Olives, you recall, is where Jesus said that he would return, that his feet would land on the Mount of Olives and it would split in two. So that's one of the highest points in the area around Jerusalem. There are a couple of mountain peaks that are a little over 3,000 feet high. As far as the general area is concerned, the elevation was higher in the Jerusalem area than other parts of the country. If you look on a map, for example, Tel Aviv is one of the major cities in Israel now. It's actually their official capital, and it's on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, so it's basically at sea level. Nazareth, 85 or so miles north, stands at an elevation of 1,600 feet. And a little further north than that, a little bit west, the Sea of Galilee. Interestingly, the Sea of Galilee is about 700 feet below sea level. So Jerusalem stands above the rest of the nation in a figurative sense, as far as the people are concerned, or in a literal sense, as far as the people are concerned, and also in a figurative sense, because that's where they would go to worship God. That was where their temple was. That's where they offered sacrifices to God. That's where they worshiped him. And they always went up to Jerusalem. You notice that, especially in the Gospels, where there's reference to them traveling toward Jerusalem. They always go up to Jerusalem. We use a different preposition when we talk about where we are going in relation to where we are. My wife and I were at the Feast of Tabernacles at Orange Beach. We drove down to Alabama. And when it was over, we drove up to Pittsburgh. Now, that kind of goes along with the map, right? North is up and south is down. That's kind of the orientation that we use. The people in the biblical times understood it in a different way. Jerusalem was above all other cities. It was more important, and it happened to be geographically higher as well. When we drive east to west, we go over. We go over to Ohio to visit our daughter. We go over to Virginia to visit our son. So that we have that map orientation. But the Israelites always traveled up to Jerusalem. And when they looked to the hills, they did so with this understanding. They were looking to God. They were looking toward Jerusalem. And specifically, they're looking to him for help. I will lift up my eyes. From whence comes my help? My help comes from the Eternal who made heaven and earth. I'll just make reference to a couple of other passages where the hills are used in a sense to represent God's authority and the prominence of the city of Jerusalem. Psalm 87, verse 1. Psalm 125, verse 2. And Psalm 133, verse 3. So looking to the hills in this sense means to look to God. And that was the point that we started with in Psalm 127, that we always are looking to God. It is from him that our help will come. We continue in Psalm 121. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He will keep our lives stable and secure. Now, there will be circumstances where our feet may be on slippery places. There are times in life that are challenging, and we have to be even more diligent to keep our footing, but God will help us to be stable. He is the one who delivers that help. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel shall not slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade and at your right hand. God is there for us and with us under all circumstances. He protects us from the heat of day, in a sense, or at least from the heat and the difficulties of trials. The word keeper can be translated protector. God stands guard over our lives. But we have the responsibility of looking to him, to look to him for that care and that protection. When we stop and think about it, I mean, we assume these things, but it's, think of how important it is that God never sleeps or slumbers. We easily and quickly grow weary. And for us, frankly, other verses we could look at show us that sleep is a blessing. It's something we need. We need that rest. We need that peace in our lives for sleep. But God is not a human being. God is not a man. He doesn't have to sleep. And he never slumbers. He never dozes off. One aspect of the greatness of God that I find so very amazing, because it's so different from me, is that God never changes. God doesn't have a bad day or a good day. God is always there. He doesn't wake up some mornings, and he never slumbers or sleeps, but he's not like me, wake up some morning and just don't feel right. Don't know why. Just kind of feel down a little bit. God doesn't have those down days. God never forgets. He never gets distracted. He doesn't get weary. He's not late. He's always there whenever we go to call upon him. He is the one who can bless our efforts as he grants us our protection. Verse 4, again, he doesn't slumber or sleep. You might just think of that in contrast to what Elijah said when he was mocking the worshipers of Baal. Remember, they were trying to call down their god to set this sacrifice on fire, and Elijah said, "Well, we'll shout a little louder. Maybe your god is asleep. Maybe he's off someplace and not paying attention." And it's a very almost a humorous approach and a sarcastic one that Elijah took with those worshipers of Baal. But our God is always there. And how fundamental and basic it is for us to always to be looking to him to bless our efforts in whatever those efforts are about. Again, sometimes we're thinking about the strength we need to deal with a trial, or sometimes the strength we need to overcome a weakness in our lives. Those are efforts that we put forth. Obviously, we seek God's blessing as we go about those efforts. And it might just be, again, taking care of the daily responsibilities of life. God is there to make sure that our life, our household, as he puts it in Psalm 127, that we are stable in it. Solomon is an interesting man. He's an example of one who did not follow this principle. He did not understand this lesson. Solomon, we know, was a man who had virtually limitless resources and opportunities, yet his life was miserable. He didn't have the blessing of God. He didn't feel like he was accomplishing anything that was meaningful or worthwhile. I want to read part of the first chapter of Ecclesiastes. And I'm going to read this to you from the Living Bible. Now, I don't often quote from that particular Bible. It's not even a translation. It's a paraphrase. And that means that someone who's gone through this and kind of rephrased the sentences to make them more something we can understand a little more clearly. It's not a word-for-word translation. It's just kind of someone's interpretation of the sense of these verses. But in this case, and often actually in the writings section of Scripture, it's helpful to us to see the Scriptures presented to us in that way. So in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, we'll read part of it here. It says, "The author, Solomon of Jerusalem, King David's son, the preacher." He says, "In my opinion, nothing is worthwhile. Everything is futile. For what does a man get for all his hard work? Generations come and go, but it makes no difference. The sun rises and sets and hurries around to rise again. The wind blows south and north and here and there, twisting back and forth, going nowhere. The rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. The water returns again to its rivers and flows back to the sea. Everything is unutterably weary and tiresome. No matter how much we see, we never are satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we're never content. Kind of a bleak outlook on life, isn't it? But, you know, again, consider what Solomon was experiencing. He was experiencing the cycles of life without really any understanding of what that was about, that it did lead to some kind of a purpose and had a meaning to it. He was living completely by himself, apart from God. Drop down to verse 12. He says, I, the preacher, was king of Israel, living in Jerusalem, and I applied myself to search for understanding about everything in the universe. And here's what he concluded. I discovered that the lot of man, which God has dealt to him, is not a happy one. It is all foolishness chasing the wind. It's amazing how dark and bleak his life became. He had at his hand every resource that a human being could want. He was the king over the most powerful nation on earth. He had uncountable wealth, and he had not only time, but opportunity to, as he put it, try to understand everything in the universe, all that he could learn and understand about the world that we live in. But there was one thing he did not have, and that was a spiritual dimension. For all that he did not have a connection with God. He was doing everything on his own. Now, since none of us has ever experienced it, it's difficult for us to believe that wealth can destroy a person. It's hard for us to understand. But for all of his wisdom, for all of his education, for all of his resources, Solomon was a failure. Solomon came to this empty, desolate conclusion. And what he decided confirms what we read in Psalm 127. Unless God is involved in building our lives, then it will come to nothing. We'll do everything in vain. It'll be worthless effort that we're putting forth. For all our toil and work, no matter how much wealth we might be able to acquire, whatever we accomplish does not matter unless God is blessing our efforts. And so we go to him each day to ask him to bless our efforts on that day. They're not world-changing things that we're going to do, but we know that whatever we do will work better when we receive God's blessing. We also know there are going to be difficult days sometimes too. I've kind of marveled at this as well. Sometimes your day gets off to a pretty good start, and maybe you feel like you've really felt comforted and strengthened by your time in prayer, and then you go off into the day and everything falls apart. There are bad days and good days, and we can put all that in context. We know that we learn our lessons, and God doesn't promise us that we're going to live sealed off from and spared any challenges. But the point is that whatever that day holds, we want God to be there with us. It's so fundamental, so basic, and so important. Solomon didn't get it. He set out to learn everything in the universe, but he didn't learn about his place in the universe or God's purpose for him in this universe. Now, perhaps he did come to that conclusion. You see at the end of the book that he at least finally reaches the point where he says that he understands that the whole responsibility of man is to obey God and keep his commandments. So maybe he learned some of those lessons along the way. But certainly, as we start to see at the outset of this book, that understanding was not there. He was a very frustrated and bleak and lonely person. About 900 years later, the Apostle Paul took a whole different approach when he considered his life and the place of God in it. Let's look at his example, Philippians, the third chapter. Philippians chapter 3. Whole different culture, whole different time, and a very different man. Philippians 3, we're going to just break into the flow of things here in verse 4. Verse 4, the first part of it is the conclusion of a previous sentence. But I want to start there in the middle in verse 4. Paul writes that if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. He's going to get into some discussion here about what do we have to be proud of in terms of what we have accomplished. The point he's making is that if anyone has anything to be pleased with himself about, it would be me. That's what Paul is saying. Because look at where I came from and the experience that I grew up with. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. He kind of thinks back here, meditates back, writes about his own personal background. And that if there's anyone in the church that would have anything to be proud of, it would be him. He was studying to be a rabbi. He was a very faithful, a very zealous person. He was a member of the tribe of Benjamin, and he was circumcised the eighth day, so he was part of that physical covenant that God made with Abraham. In his culture, in his time, he had a great deal to be proud of and to take pride in. His pedigree was impeccable. His reputation was outstanding. Kind of, in some sense, similar to the starting point that Solomon had, where he had everything humanly going in his favor. And he had accomplished a great deal. And it says another, I believe in the book of Galatians, that he was studying at the feet of Gamaliel, who was a well-known Jewish rabbi and a teacher of rabbis. That was the career path that Paul was on. So what does Paul then view or think of his own accomplishments and where he came from? I think you know the answer to that. It continues right here in verse 7. It says, what things were gain to me, these I have counted loss for Christ. Yet indeed I also count all things loss for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them as rubbish, that I might gain Jesus Christ. Paul came to understand what was of true value in life. He was a man of diligence, and he continued in his service to God to be a man of great diligence and commitment and dedication. But he redirected that energy, and he did so with seeking and searching out the things that are truly important. Verse 7 talks about the excellence of the knowledge of God. Excellence is a word that means something of surpassing value. In the Amplified Version, uses these phrases to emphasize the meaning of excellence, something of overwhelming preciousness, something with surpassing value and supreme advantage. Paul came to see what it meant to have a connection to God, to have the ability to put forth his effort in a more meaningful way. And so he valued what he had come to understand. The excellence of the knowledge of Christ, and count what he was doing before as rubbish. That's what it says in the New King James. The word in the Greek means something that is worthless, or it's unwanted material that is rejected. It's thrown out. I think that the King James uses the word dung to to in this instance. So it's obviously something that Paul came to realize was not of any value. And yet it was a great accomplishment. What he was doing was, in the eyes generally of others, of something that was great, great value. Being connected to Jesus Christ and seeing his hand in our working in our lives and directing us each day is of the most fundamental importance to us. Consider John chapter 15. John, the 15th chapter. John 15, verse 4, Jesus says, "Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing." Pretty straightforward and clear statement, isn't it? Without Jesus Christ, unless we are attached to him and abide in him, we accomplish nothing. Sadly, a lot of people get clear to the end of their lives before they realize that. Because they're busy doing stuff, they're busy with their accomplishments, with their efforts, working toward their goals, only to come to realize that it really is not of any value. There's a lesson I've mentioned before that really fits, I think, this idea or this understanding of expending our energy in the right way. The point is that we make sure our ladder is up against the right wall. That when we get to the top of that ladder, we're where we thought we would be, and that where we want to be, and we have made progress in a direction that is of some importance. If you get to the top of the ladder and you're against the wrong wall, then you've wasted all that energy getting up there. Jesus said we must abide with him. To abide is a close relationship. It's an intimate relationship. You abide with your family. You live there. You're with them all the time. That household is the center of your life. And you'll see in this context here in John 15 and other verses in that general area here in these chapters of John, that Jesus uses that word abide frequently. It emphasizes our connection to him, our faithfulness to Jesus Christ. And if we're separated from him, we can't even survive, much less grow. So, again, this has to do with the orientation of our lives, that we wish everything to be done in his way, that we seek out and study and understand what Jesus Christ would have of us and how to live and all the different kinds of circumstances that we deal with. Certainly it has to do with our prayer life as well. We each day begin seeking that blessing and that direction from him, understanding the application of the way that he's teaching us. Peter talks about the need to grow in the grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ. That's an application as well of this sense of abiding with him, that everything we are continually learning about being the kind of person that he would have us be, seeking his kingdom and seeking his righteousness first in our lives. It's all part of that very simple principle of our work, our lives being blessed by Jesus Christ. It doesn't make any less of our effort, but it makes our effort meaningful. This house that the Lord is building can also represent our personal character and our strength in times of difficulty and challenge. Turn to Matthew chapter 7. the Lord is building our house. Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 24. Jesus says that whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. We find ourselves connected to Jesus Christ when we obey his words. When we build our lives on the solid foundation of his teachings, that strength, that character that we build will hold us in place even when life becomes stormy and difficult. The house that's being built is built on the rock, on this stability, when it is built on our understanding and practice and application of what we learn. There's no substitute for hard work, but that hard work must be blessed, and we are then strengthened by the help of Jesus Christ and of God the Father as we seek them in building that house. There's no guarantee that this is going to be an easy thing. There's no guarantee, again, that life will not have its challenges, but what's most important is that life will have its full meaning. Again, go back to Paul's example in Philippians chapter 4. Paul's words here is he definitely understood and had learned this lesson of our lives being established by that connection to and help from Jesus Christ and God the Father. Philippians chapter 4, verse 10. Of course, we remember that Paul was in prison when he wrote this epistle. We read here in chapter 4, verse 10, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now, at last, your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked the opportunity. So, this is speaking of the congregation at Philippi and their efforts to support Paul and to show their care for him while he was in prison. They sent items to him to help him to be more comfortable. Prisons were different in the first century than they are now. And those who were imprisoned often had to rely on others from outside to provide their basic needs. And so this was what the people in Philippi were willing to do in support of Paul while he was in prison. Other books that were written at the same time include Colossians and Philemon, also written during this time when Paul was in prison. You can see the story of his imprisonment back in the last few chapters of Acts. But Paul recognized that although the members cared about him, that they had lacked opportunity, perhaps the resources, to be able to help him. But he was thankful when they did, when they were able. Verse 11, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. That's a very difficult lesson to learn. And we find ourselves at different times in our lives. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's more difficult. Not dealing with the kinds of trials that Paul did, but we have our own ups and downs in our lives and the challenges that we face. Sometimes life just gets wearisome and troubling. Sometimes life seems to be more pleasant, and we have good times in our lives. But the lesson throughout, whether good or bad times, Paul says, is the same one. The way that we deal with easier times is the same way that we deal with more difficult times. We tend to think of times of when we're wanting or suffering to be times of trial and times when we have to rely in faith on God. It's true, but we also have to learn how to rely on God faithfully when things are going more easily for us as well. That was the problem that Solomon had. He, even though he was wealthy, didn't have a connection with God, and so he squandered his wealth depending on it rather than depending on God. But whether we are abased or whether we are abound, to use Paul's words, the lesson is always the same. Verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's the bottom line. That's what it comes down to. That's why we look to God to build the house, to strengthen us in our efforts, in the various levels and ways in our lives. Because anything we can accomplish must be through Jesus Christ and the help that he provides for us. Verse 14 continues the thought. Verse 14, nevertheless, you've done well that you shared in my distress. So, again, he's thanking the church for their help. And recognizing that as they're able, they're more than willing to reach out to him. Now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. So he's continues to acknowledge the fact that they had been faithful to him. Philippi is located in that area, and as he traveled through and set up churches in other places nearby, the people at that location continued to give him support. For even in Thessalonica, you sent aid once and again for my necessities. So while he was even with other congregations, Thessalonica was another church in that same general area, and when he was there, the people in Philippi continued to send their support to him. Verse 17, not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that abounds to your account. So in other words, he's telling them that because of what they are doing, they'll be blessed. They'd be blessed for the fact that they were being supportive of him. Indeed, I have all and abound. This is written by a man who's in prison, a man who's under the threat of execution. Earlier in this book, in chapter 1, Paul states that he's not even sure if he's going to survive this particular situation. And so he, in that very life-threatening moment, says that I have all and I abound. I am full, having received from Epaphroditus the things sent from you, a sweet-smelling aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. And then again, verse 19, and my God shall supply all your need according to his riches in glory by Christ Jesus. Paul shows his concern for them and points out that as they help him, God will help them. So it all has to do with this connection to and reliance upon Jesus Christ. Paul expresses his gratitude and also his confidence that their efforts would be rewarded, that God would in turn take care of them. So let's go back one more time to Psalm 127. Paul knew and understood and learned that lesson. Solomon did not. Solomon didn't understand, and he had even, in some ways, greater opportunities, greater wealth than Paul. The lesson is one that we can focus and apply in our lives every day. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It's vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. In other words, it's pointless for us to go through all that effort on our own. God will provide for us and take care of us when we look to him. So there's a common denominator that we see when we consider the efforts that we put forth every day, when we consider the meaning and purpose of our lives, and when we consider the times of stress and difficulty. We will always be successful, whatever stage of life that we're in, only if we seek God's blessing. The human tendency that we have to fight is to wander off by ourselves rather than continually seeking His presence and His strength. We view sometimes life as a pattern. We just go through the same routines over and over again. And it becomes something that we can do almost in our sleep, almost with our eyes closed. But we learn that at all times, in all circumstances, as familiar as it might seem, or as difficult as it might seem, when we look to God, He will guard our lives. Life is challenging. Life is exhausting. Life is exhilarating. There are all kinds of experiences that we have. We have those difficult times. We have joyful times. But you know, when it comes right down to it, life is just simply a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort. And the only way to make sense of it, the only way for it to come together for us in a meaningful way, is to be sure, as we see here in Psalm 127, to be certain that in each of our lives, the Lord is building our house.